Welcome to the Josh Bolton Show, where we dive into interesting and inspiring conversations. And now, your host, Josh Bolton.
Welcome, everybody. Today on the show, we have Linda Ulrich. We're going to go into positivity, happiness, her network. She has all this great stuff going from, I believe she said, a dentist to running this positivity media company. I'll let her just explain it better. Here's Linda herself.
Hi. I'm so glad to speak to your audience. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you.
Well, where do we start? We are in dark times as the day that we're recording this. It seems to be there's a little light on the horizon. The pandemic is starting to lift a bit.
Yes.
And people are finding ways to make a life even in the confusion. But I've the last TEDx talk I did, they referred to me as the positive media mogul. So
that's awesome.
So, yeah. I have a global endeavor that is built to change the negative dialogue about our times, Josh. And I'm happy to share the story of how a dentist becomes a global media mogul.
Absolutely.
And along the way, I'm going to give people a lot of practical tips today in our interview about how you see a better world on the screens in your life, because it's there. The first thing I want you to hear from my lips, pretty much more important than my story, is that what we see in our online lives is only a slice of reality. It's a tiny slice. There's this enormous world that is still very amazing out there. There is an enormous wave of goodness and progress happening in the world right now that almost no one knows about because of the way the internet is built. So we've got plenty of time today. Relax. I'm going to tell you about some secrets of the internet that I've discovered that will also help you on your journey to get your arms around your online life and make it more positive than ever. So first, remember, the internet, what you see in your online life, is only a slice of reality. The second thing to really understand is that the internet should be a tool, nothing more. It's like any other construct that humans have come up with. The printing press, the cotton gin, the steam engine, the automobile. These are just human constructs. The internet is no more powerful over us. I know it's hard to imagine that if you're struggling to find anything positive going on in the world. But by the end of this chat, we'll have given you a whole bunch of tools.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So I have been my father was a physician. He was one of the old timey doctors that delivered your baby, took out your appendix. You had his home phone. He did house calls. The day you or your kid went through the barbed wire fence on your mini bike, he met you in the emergency room, no matter what was happening, and sewed the kid back up. So he was one of those guys. And my husband and I both were childhood sweethearts. We had the heart to be those kind of doctors. And we never saw my father, never. He was not at one single basketball game or swim meet or anything. He was constantly in the service of others. But Dr. Doolin was a dentist next door. He drove in that driveway every day at 6:05, still wearing the cardigan he wore in high school. And he was there for his kids, and we could always see him cooking out on the grill on the back porch. And that life looked, he was a wonderful gentleman, a great humanitarian, great health professional, but that life looked better to us. So that's how I come to be a little bit different dentist than you might have in your mind's eye. So my husband and I have always been working hard to keep the humanity in healthcare. We find something to celebrate with every single patient in their lives because we really dive deep into people's lives and we know them as a part of their family. So as long ago as 2011, 12, 13, things were going south with all of our attitudes. I know that seems hard to remember because we're in such a bad way now with the negative news and the division, but it was beginning then. And my patients, I started to have these conversations with people, and I was shocked. People were having downward spiral conversations more and more frequently with me, that, you know, the future was hopeless. There was nothing good to say about anyone out in the wider world. It was getting tough. So what I did, like so many people, I would say, gosh, somebody's got to do something about this. Over and over, when I would have these conversations with otherwise cheerful people who are now looking at the future with dread, I would say, gosh, somebody's got to do something about this. Well, you know how that works very often. One day I got an email from a young man I'd known since he was a toddler, and he was writing me from a foxhole in a really bleak part of the world. And he thought of me when he was in his darkest moment, because I'd always given him something to celebrate. I think that's what it was, but it was a wake-up call. Suddenly I was moved to action. I thought, there's got to be someplace on the internet that I can send this kid for word of insight and innovation and things that celebrate the future for us all, because I knew it was out there. Mm-hmm. And the reason I knew it was out there, because I had spent a life living abroad, traveling to bleak places with my children, doing philanthropic things. My kids have slept on plywood in Tibet, and they've gotten lost in the Andes with us. And gosh, and the thing that we knew and that hurt me so badly when I heard patients lament about the future was that I'd seen people in the bleakest places have so much generosity, so much ingenuity. Gosh, people can do so much with mm-hmm. so little. And what I knew was that we were never going to see that slice of reality on the internet or the negative news. Never.
Right.
So when Cameron wrote me that email, I went on a mad search of the internet to find some place to send him so that he could know it was still an amazing world. And I spent 3 weeks looking. And of course, as you might guess, there was no place. No place without a ton of politics, lots and lots of commercialism, a huge agenda of some sort. There were places that called themselves good news, but you had to accept the politics or the commercialism. So one day I just snapped and I built it. I just built a place where anyone can go. It's called Ever Widening Circles. Josh, when will this podcast publish?
In about a month.
Okay. I we'll still be there. We're going to rebrand into something called the Conspiracy of Goodness Network. And so people, I think it'll be about a month down the line from when we're chatting here today.
Will it be a new website itself?
No, I'll tell you. The story of the Conspiracy of Goodness is something to plug in right now. So What happened with Ever Widening Circles was I started writing one article a day, every day, to prove that it was still an amazing world, and not puppies in mailbox things, like real things in the news that we're not hearing about. And my daughter joined me in 2015 when she graduated from Harvard. And then we had a real project going. It grew so fast. We had 170,000 Facebook fans instantly. We went viral on Reddit. We had 1.7 million people try and get on the website all at one time one afternoon.
Ooh.
Yeah, it wasn't an article that made it to the front page of Reddit. It was just the fact that we exist. People were celebrating the fact that there was some place without politics and commercialism to find word of goodness and progress. So we'd been writing away and having all this success and really changing the negative dialogue about our times. And one day I was on the, so we write articles, these Ever Widening Circles. You're going to go in there and find thousands of links to really good places on the internet. Amazing stories of innovators who are solving some of the world's most vexing problems in the most curious and ways that are worth celebrating. Mm-hmm. And that will still be there when we rebrand. But we've discovered this phrase, the conspiracy of goodness. And we think it's easier to remember than ever widening circles.
Yeah.
And a conspiracy of goodness is what's happening right now. There's this quiet wave of people like you and I doing what they can do to make the world a better place, right? This podcast mm-hmm. that you're recording, this is what you decided you could do.
Yes.
Right? There's other people who volunteer to, you know, for the food shelf or in my little town. My gosh, 3 weeks ago, they had a little event that started out so little to raise money for a teen center. They raised $400,000.
Whoa.
For a teen center. Yes. I'm telling you, I've got goosebumps. It's out there. There's this wave of goodness and progress that we aren't focusing on. So one day I was talking to a thought leader. So these people that we write about at Ever Widening Circles are ordinary people like you and I very often. And although they are doing extraordinary things. So I was talking to one day and he said, Dr. Linda, you know what you're doing sounds exactly like the story of conspiracy of goodness. You know that story, don't you? And I said, no, I don't. So he says, go look it up and then you'll know what you're up to. But I knew when he said those three words, Josh, that this is what we had been looking at. There was a conspiracy of goodness going on. So I found the story. The original story of the conspiracy of goodness, the first time I can find it ever mentioned, those three words together, comes from a story from World War II. So there was a little tiny village in France called Le Chambon that managed to save 3,500 Jews from a nearby concentration camp at great risk to their own lives. And with no organization, this little farming town saved thousands for years, and most of them were orphans. So in 1986, there was a Rabbi Harold Schulweis giving a talk in Europe that he called The Conspiracy of Evil. And he tells about a time when he was giving that talk in Belgium, and an old man stood up in the back of the room to say he had been one of the Dutch rescuers. And the old man said, why does everyone just focus on the conspiracy of evil that was World War II? He said, do you think I could have hid an entire family in my house for years without the active participation of the milkman, the mailman, and the neighbors? The old man said, no, for every one person saved, there were seven who were rescuers. It was, he said, a conspiracy of goodness. Now, Josh, that is who we are. We are not what we see on social media and the negative news cycle. We Right. are doers. We are helpers. We are rescuers and givers. We have been for hundreds of thousands of years. The advent of the internet did not change that.
Yeah.
So we've decided that because what we know what we've now we know what to call what we've been writing about, this wave of goodness and progress. It's a conspiracy of goodness. And we think if you look back through history, this sort of thing has happened over and over again. In fact, I have a TED talk, a TEDx talk that I did that people can check out called Exposing the Conspiracy of Goodness, where I give some examples throughout history where the same thing happened, where ordinary people like you and I just started quietly turning against some prevailing craziness. Child labor. You know, at the end of the Industrial Revolution, the 1920s, there were 700,000 children in the United States working 12-hour days under the age of 15.
Mm-hmm.
And then people started to turn away from that. They knew it was madness. The yeah. same with women not being able to vote or what have you. So, so what I do, if you want to put it succinctly, is I am elevating and pointing to this enormous wave of goodness and progress that's going on in the world. And I talk to people thought leaders all over the world. And I have my own podcast called the Conspiracy of Goodness Podcast. We publish all these articles about people. We have a network that we've created called the Conspiracy of Goodness Network, where people who are doing good can go and find each other and help solve each other's problems. Because I'm not sure if you've run into this or not, Josh, but I've had to learn this whole business by trial and error.
Oh, absolutely.
We have been ripped off so many times. I can't even begin to tell you, because we're trusting, we're nice. And then somebody says they can do one thing for us and then they leave us high and dry. It's really something.
Yeah. That's the biggest one. I do martial arts and my instructor, are your guests good? I'm like, no, like it's actually at times really annoying because they promise the world and then they never deliver. And I'm like, I told him I have nothing against humanity. It might be just a rotten apple. I just, for some reason, get that one rotten apple every time. But I told him now when they promise the world, I expect nothing. I said, it's not against them. It's just, I'm not getting my hopes up. I'm not going to be sad because it doesn't happen kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So somebody like you and I, how would we know how to actually put a podcast together? How would we know a marketing? Like we had a snafu with three different web developers that took advantage of our good nature. We finally have one now that's the best guy in the whole world. But, you know, on the Conspiracy of Goodness Network, we are creating a place, a platform for people who are trying to do good in the world to come together and share resources and probably stories like you and I both have of being taken advantage of, so that we all get smarter faster without, because we can be a million points of light out there in the darkness shouting that, you know, we're here, we're doing this great thing with good intention. And the way the internet works, the negativity just is what rises to the top. So no one will know we exist.
Nope. That's the biggest thing. Actually, I've just noticed in general, observing people, is one of a previous job I worked at. He pretty much said okay, there's something wrong with the people. Like, what's wrong? So we went through and I explained to him, your morale doesn't exist in your company, et cetera, et cetera. I gave him some tips to fix it, even though I'm just a simple security guard and my observation skills were higher than normal. It's one of those I never realized it with hindsight. I now understand what it was. So long story short, essentially, their warehouse, specifically that shift I was working, was the worst. Like, everyone knew not to repeat whatever warehouse is doing. They suddenly became the best. And all I told him is raise the morale. I said, you make like 10K a month. He's like, yeah. I'm like, is like $1,000 off going to really like hurt you? He's like, no. I said, buy him a gift card, $100 gift card. That's going to mean the world to them, kind of thing.
Say thank you.
Yeah. Say thank you. Literally, I told him, buy him a good taco guy. Don't buy the cheap, like, guy you know down the street with the cheap meat. Like, get the real stuff. So they will be so grateful that they'll call each other out on their dumb stuff. Is suddenly they're calling him like, what are you doing different? Now your shift that was a problem is better, kind of thing. And it went insanely viral. And that's where he's like, well, I don't understand. Like, it's just tactics you showed me. I'm like, no, fear spreads quickly, but it also fades quickly. That's why it always has to be pumped. Happiness spreads slowly but efficiently, kind of thing.
That's a great way to say it, Josh. And you know why it spreads slowly and efficiently. So I bet that you've had a guest who's talked about this, at least danced around the edges of it. But okay, it's important that we get right to something that's very important about what you just said and what I've observed. Okay, So first of all, everybody should know that I'm a very early adopter of technology. I've been fixing teeth with computers since 2003.
That's cool.
And I only say that in that I'm fearless in the face of technology. Okay. So for my age and stage, it's unusual. But my point is that I'm curious to a fault. The reason why I was fixing computers in 2003 is because I said, what? You can fix computers now, and you can fix the computers. I want to do that. So curiosity to a fault is, or you want to be right on the edge of that to a fault thing. And it sounds like you're like that. And I would imagine you attract listeners who are naturally curious too, because I looked at the kind of people you're interviewing. And somebody that would want that much diversity in what they're giving their attention to is pretty cool.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't say it, but I kind of have to now. It's like, I don't judge people. We are where we are. It's not our place to tell them what they should and shouldn't do, but it's also good to know their perspective to understand, because maybe this year, for some reason, one of my guests in the Mac didn't click with people, but in like 2 years, it's going to be all the difference in the world kind of thing. But it's one of those, wasn't curious to talk to him.
Absolutely.
Kind of thing.
Okay. So here's, I've gone from ordinary web user, largely, even though I was a tech savvy person, I really never got on the train of the internet being, something I was just focused in on 9 hours a day. You know how you can check your phone, see how much time you spent on the internet?
Yes. It's just scary. The graphs now you can get. It's like, oh, exactly this many seconds you're on this app. It's like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me, it would be 33 minutes a day.
That's actually really good.
And this is my business.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to tell you why that is. It's because I realize that the internet is an attention economy.
Yes.
Everything about the internet is built to capture and hold our attention. They're using neuroscience against us now. And when I say they, I say
everyone.
Almost everyone.
Yeah.
Now, I have purposely gone on this journey for the last 8 years, refusing to pay to play.
Okay.
So if ever widening circles, those three words, is new to you, everwidingcircles.com or the Conspiracy of Goodness movement is new to you, it's because I haven't paid to play. I'm naturally curious. I'm fearless because of it. And I wanted to see if I could grow something without all that hype and inauthenticity. And I don't know, that's just more of the same negativity from my angle. So the internet is an attention economy. It's built to capture and hold our attention, and it uses neuroscience against us. And here is something that pertains to your story about what we need to do to improve morale. So we have two parts of our brain that we use all day long, every day. We have this part of our brain that is referred to as the lizard brain. That's the really, really old part of our brain that was so important 40,000 years ago.
Yes.
Okay. 40,000 years ago, you had to know that if you heard a twig snap, that could be a saber-toothed tiger. And so you had that part of your brain had to be constantly on 24/7, scanning your environment for signs of danger and disorder. And scarcity was huge. I mean, there was no abundance 40,000 years ago. Our brain had to be about getting all the resources we could possibly get and hanging on to them.
And then rationing it out. Yeah.
Yes. Right?
Seriously, that's one thing I've told people. They're like, oh, fasting's bad. I'm like, no. So think about it this way. Our ancestors, the root of all humans are in Africa. Do you just randomly see a pizza in Africa on the plains? They're like, no. I'm like, exactly. So if they found an elk, they hunted it, they killed it, skinned it all, that elk maybe could have fed the tribe for a week. So there's usually one guy that would volunteer and be like, I'll cut off, feed the children kind of thing. So is it hence why we can go 2-3 days and our bodies are fine? Because we adapted to the scarcity. And they're like,
most people live like that. That's exactly right. But it does create some impulses, some knee-jerk responses in our mind to our abundance. We don't necessarily share easy.
No, that's right? Even for the best. That's still hard.
Right, because that's so hardwired. And part of my message is teaching people about how the internet is messing with our brains and how to shift up, because there is this other part of our brain. There's this part that's right behind our forehead called the cerebral cortex. And that's where we can think about, I better hold my words carefully around the fire tonight. 40,000 years ago, you couldn't spout off the way people do on social media now, because you'd have to sleep with one eye open forever. If you, if you made somebody in your group unhappy, they could hit you on the head with a rock in the night and you'd be done for. So back then we had to control our emotions. We had to control what we said to others. We had to nurture our relationships because we depended on each other so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this part of our brain, a newer part called the cerebral cortex, where we can go, oh, wait a minute. I'm just going to pause before I speak. It's the part where we can put ourselves in other people's shoes and have empathy. It's the part where we can say, well, if I don't say this today, then I'm going to get this tomorrow. You can calculate the future.
Right.
But that part of our brain is not generally on when we're on the internet. In our online lives, we are on autopilot. The internet didn't come with an instruction manual. And most of it, us, when we are there, when we're scroll, 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 click, scroll, mm-hmm. scroll, scroll, click, that is a classic example of the time when you're using your amygdala, this lizard brain. And what's getting your attention, what you're stopping on and clicking on, is signs of danger and disorder.
But like
or
I said,
scarcity.
Yeah, I was like, but that's our lizard brain. That's like you said, they're using neuroscience against us. It reacts to that. It's not that we want to look at the terrible car crash or bomb, but it's like the, oh, that could have been me. So wait, what's going
that's
on
right.
kind of thing.
That's a very good point, Josh. Like every time we judge somebody else's behavior, we've got to think about how we would react very likely in the same situation. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad, when he retired, he became the doctor at a maximum security prison. Because he was a kind person, he had 40 years of humanity. And you know, Josh, he would come home and he would tell stories about the inmates. Now, this is a maximum security prison in right. Illinois. So it was drawing from hard life in Chicago and St. Louis. And he would say, you know, but for an accident of birth, I could have been that guy that I talked to today. You know, my dad grew up in a household that was very, very poor, but they valued education. So it was an accident of birth that he made those. But he always made a point to say, you know, a guy I talked to today was just one choice that he made wrong that sent him down this life path. Or by accident of birth, he never had a dad and his mom was a drug addict. Where could he have ended up? You know, so this is what This is the cerebral cortex, the higher thinking part of our brain. They call it the executive function part of our brain. Can not judge, can choose not to judge, can choose to we can remind ourselves that everyone's carrying a burden, everyone.
Yeah.
And that some people carry their burdens better than others.
So true. That's so true.
So your story about a guy loosening his grip a little bit on his own resources and sharing them with the people that are earning him money. That is somebody that's just had an aha moment. Thanks mm-hmm. to you, sounds like. And it totally made sense in this part of his brain. It totally made sense that he could give up a little bit of what he had and do something generous. And that would actually do more for him business-wise than being stingy.
Well, he made so much more because there wasn't products being randomly destroyed now.
Right. It, right.
Yeah. It's just because the morale went up. He's like, I'm actually making more money paying the extra thousand, whatever mm-hmm. to make them feel better. I'm like, yeah. It's one of those. I told him intrinsically humans, we do want to help. Yeah. It'd be nice if we can get paid more, but ultimately we're a very service-based creature.
Absolutely.
And to just say thank you for your service means the world to them. Kind of thing.
Absolutely. Okay, we're dancing far too close to something that I talk to a lot of people about, so we might as well go there. I know that you do speak a lot about business on your podcast. So, well, there is this huge, wonderful thing happening right now, along with the conspiracy of goodness. I think we are shifting from the attention. Let me tell you just a little bit about the attention economy before I tell you what I think is coming now.
Okay.
So I call what we're in right now the attention economy. Nothing matters but getting and holding our attention, whether it's on the internet or billboards or radio or what have you, right? Okay. Well, this started with radio. We've been in this attention economy for about 100 years. Now, that was radio came along, and that was the first time you could interrupt people's thoughts in mass. You could interrupt a mass of people's thoughts.
That's true.
So there's two kinds of ways to get people's attention. Either you interrupt them at the right moment, or you do something or say something outrageous.
Yes, and I've learned that one.
Right? It's really the attention economy is all full of marketing examples of interrupting or doing something outrageous. Now, that outrageous can be like this fabulous commercial that Microsoft did 30 years ago when they first put out the Mac. It's like an extravaganza. I mean, that is outrageous to have made a commercial that felt like a Hollywood movie. That was outrageous. I don't mean outrageous has to be mean. It can be outrageously beautiful. It can be outrageously whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've been in the attention economy for 100 years, let's say. And the advent of the internet made this, it brought the attention economy to the level of like trying to think straight in a room with the fire alarm going off.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the way it feels.
It really does. And I think it really started, nothing against the big social media, but it's when Twitter, when it first started, it was actually text messages for those younger who are like, what the hell? Like, it was text. I remember I would literally text a random number, so it would post, and everyone else would get a text when Josh sent something. And at a certain point, I'm like, why don't we just trade numbers? Like, why do we have to send it to something to send it to us, kind of thing?
Right.
And I think also with that and YouTube, when it's both of them at its roots meant no like evil, no harm, but it slowly switched to, like you said, the attention. It's like, wait, if we do this, we get more people. If we do get more people, we can sell more ads, kind of thing.
Right. You've absolutely stumbled up on it. So I have a book I published September 1st. Just 9 days before that Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma came out. Have you heard of The Social Dilemma?
You see, this is where I live under a rock. I've given up all social media. I don't really watch Netflix anymore.
Okay, great.
So tell me about it.
Good. Okay. So a lot of your listeners will have heard of this very famous. It was for sure the most famous documentary of 2020 that Netflix put out. It was called The Social Dilemma. And they did this very clever thing, which I thought was very useful. They got the inventors of all the things that we know today, the infinite scroll, the like button, the algorithm that serves you your next YouTube video. Mm-hmm. They actually collected the people who invented those things, mm-hmm. and they sat them on a bar stool in a warehouse, in an old broken down warehouse, and they just interviewed them. So it's person after person who, like you just said, had good intention. The algorithms that serve us what's next were created to just be a shortcut, mm-hmm. so that we could get what we want quicker. So person by person goes through in this documentary and tells the story of how and why it was invented and then what happened to it. And of course, none of them work for these companies anymore. Mm-hmm. And all of them tell us a diabolical story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, about what happened and where we are today. Now, it could be that this is more doom and gloom and people avoid. A lot of times when I ask people if they've seen the documentary, Josh, they say, oh, I keep meaning to watch it, but it's just more craziness. I just can't. And I go, I know. I'm the positive media mogul. But here's the deal. Yes, it's something that we should all know. It's not more doom and gloom. They've got a really good storyline that runs through it. It's very productive. And for gosh sakes, if you have children and you're handing a cell phone to your children, I'm telling you, I'm a parent. I raise three good kids that are nice. And there are some things children don't get to choose. That's what my pediatrician told me one day. Dr. Linda, there's some things a 14-year-old don't get to choose. And if I could translate it into how we handle the whole cell phone deal with our 14-year-olds or our kids, mm-hmm. here's the way I would handle it. I would say, you get to have this phone as long as you'll sit down and watch this documentary with me so you know the game being played with your emotions.
Well, okay, I'm going to side story on that. It's just tying the same thing. I used to work for a school district, a yard duty supervisor. I was young. I didn't really have any financial burden. So I was like, I'll just do this, get some extra cash for the week. But what bugs me is when I was doing it, it's when the first iPhone 10 came out. Okay. The thing was expensive for its time kind of thing. It's like, yes. It's $1,500. And I'm like, and the kids just sitting there playing away. And I'm like, okay, where I worked, it was a very wealthy area. So I was like, yeah, $1,000 to them is just chump change, but it's whatever. It hurts, but it doesn't. Kid got upset with Angry Birds, yeeted that thing just across the yard into a pond, broke it. And I'm like, dude, like, if you were mad with it, like, you could have given it to a buddy or something. Like, you could have just erased it and handed it off to someone. He's like, no, mommy uses it to track me anyway. She'll buy me a new one by tonight. Wow. And I said actually aloud, I'm like, the fact that you're your age and you know this, I'm like, that's not good.
It's kind of not good. It's not good. Okay. So I can't hear you say that, tell that story without saying something that I also talk to people of all kinds. I just did a big keynote speech for the teachers, a huge group of teachers. And what I found myself saying to them is that, you know, at least in the state of Vermont, where are you from, Josh?
California.
Okay. It would surprise me if California didn't have this law too. It's the law that Vermont high schools have to teach kids keyboarding. You know how there's like a required set of things you have to take in high school? Well, one of them is keyboarding. And when I learned that, it just shocked me to my core, and here's why. Because we're teaching kids to use a device, keyboard, mm-hmm. but we're not teaching them how to behave with it, or how to live with it, or live without it. We're not teaching them internet hygiene.
No, and another one I've actually meant no, and it's one of those. It took me trial and error. Luckily, it was early stuff, and the algorithms have pushed all my stuff away, so it's not a problem. But I didn't know you're not like. This is pre-cancel culture was a huge thing. So I was just saying like, oh, like X person did this, like, oh, like boo-hoo them kind of thing. Like they're whatever. But now I realize I'm like, oh, I was playing into the cancel culture. I just didn't know it at the time. If I knew what it was, I wouldn't have said anything kind of thing.
Absolutely. Well, I am working on creating a whole lot of courses. They'll be very affordable for people that will be – people will be able to find them through this – new website I'm creating called The Business of Goodness.
Okay.
But I'm going to create a course. Thank you for reminding that. I'm going to write this down because I think we can rein this in. You know, mm-hmm. we can teach our kids that the internet is an attention economy and they're playing with their emotions. And I really do believe this Gen Zers, these kids under 22 right now, once they realize the game being played with their emotions, they will find a workaround.
If anything, I think they're already noticing, especially because most of them use TikTok, and that's the biggest thing with TikTok.
Yeah,
it's not the openly said, but they're doing this intentionally. Why am I even here? Kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, so I always say. people say, oh, well, don't we have to treat our kids differently with their privacy on the internet? Isn't it important to give them privacy? And of course, that's what every 15-year-old will cry foul about.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, I'm back to Dr. Holmes, who once looked at me and said, Linda, there are some things your 12-year-old doesn't get to choose. And if you are allowing your kids to just use a cell phone without any education, about how it's being used to to manipulate their minds and their attitudes, how to control your impulses for your Angry Birds example, right? I mean, if we aren't teaching kids that, it would be the same as any of us going on vacation and just letting our kids walk off into the jungle. You wouldn't do that. There's not a sane parent on the planet that would go on vacation in Brazil and let their kid walk off into the jungle without education. No. Never.
No.
There's too many things that can kill you. Well, guess what? On the internet, there's many, many things that can kill your worldview, that can kill your self-esteem, that can kill your future focus, what you think is possible.
Yes.
Right? This is a jungle, and we need to start treating the internet in a way that it's a tool. So what I always tell people is, back to the cotton gin and the printing press and the steam engine, we're ready for an upgrade. We're ready to revisit the role of the internet in our lives. It should be treated like a hammer, Josh. Like, a hammer is a tool. You can use it to build things, or it can be used to demolish things.
Oh, absolutely.
We need to decide which that will be. When you go to social media, for instance, you can choose to what to give your attention to. Like, I might go to, I still have Facebook page. If my sister's building a brand new porch or she's got a new puppy, I go there to see the puppy, to see the picture of the porch, and then I leave. Right? We don't have to get sucked into this black hole with our amygdala. If we go to the internet with purpose, recipe, quick exchange with a coworker, whatever it is, this is how we get out of this. We don't have to leave social media entirely. We don't have to opt out entirely. It should be a tool. And we can do that if, when we're on the internet, in our online lives, we're using this executive function part of our brain. We can say, they're just trying to get me to click on that. You know, that's executive function. But if you click on the mean headline or the picture of the blobfish or the crazy, wacky thing that your Uncle John said on Facebook against what you like, you are just letting it have at you.
One of the things I've always told people, even before I actually knew what it was, I would just say, you know, when you watch a YouTube video, if it wasn't one of those that you genuinely were sitting there laughing out loud, and not just the literal LOL, like you were really laughing, don't hit the like button kind of thing. Like, if it truly made you happy and laugh, or it was a good inspirational, maybe had some dark undertones, but it was one of those, so finally the hero hit the peak, hit the like button. This was back in like 2010, where like we kind of knew there was an algorithm, but we didn't. Now we all know. It's like, literally, as we're going around, it's like, don't click that. It'll be literally at my work. We're like, don't click that. It'll be in your algorithm now.
Okay. So, in this book that I wrote called Happiness is an Option, it gives it, what I didn't finish my thought on was that when the Netflix documentary came out, the one bad thing I can say about it is you watch the whole darn thing and it doesn't give you any plan of what to do next.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Okay. But what had just happened was that my book had just published, called Happiness is an Option. And in that book, it's very short, takes 3.5 hours to read. Okay. I give people the plan of what to do next. Once you realize the game being played with your emotions on the internet, you've got to have a plan. You need to know what to do. And what I tell people to do is I teach people these four shifts.
Okay.
I tell people that there are four shifts that you can make, and you just mentioned one of them, to see an entirely different world on the screens in your life. Because the bottom line is, what we click on, we get more of because of the algorithms. So you're absolutely right with the, okay, so here's the four shifts. And if people want to, you know, jot them down just so you can start using them immediately, but we've created a place on the internet called fourshifts.com.
Okay.
You can use the number four and then the word shifts, shifts.com. That's a hard word to pronounce, shifts. The four shifts. Okay, here they are. Ready? The first shift is pause before you click on anything. Pause, because someone is counting every click you make, every click. It's either a real person actually counting it, so they know what content to produce next, but mostly it's this algorithm problem. Every click you make is being observed, and you get more of whatever you click on, even if it's leaving you sad, horrified, or angry. Bottom line, your click is a vote. Your click is a vote. It's a vote for whatever you're giving your attention to. And that's a powerful sentence, because it means we have all the power on the internet, Josh.
Yes.
I think people feel very victimized by the internet that we have today. But my goal is to get 25% of the human beings on this planet to understand that their click is a vote. And that means we can do the second shift. Okay. We can ignore things into obscurity.
So actually, I want to add in onto that one. One thing I've told people, because they complain about, oh, so-and-so is still at it. Like, let's say Johnny Depp kind of thing. And they're like, oh, it's terrible. I'm like, do you really want him to not succeed anymore? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, stop talking about him.
Stop talking.
Literally, if you stop talking.
Right.
If you do not feed it attention, it will die.
That's right. Okay. So there was something that now these are all things I've learned going from ordinary web user to global positive media mogul, is there's something I refer to as attention juice. So we give attention juice to anything we engage in. So let's say you got politics on one side or the other, and you feel very heartfelt about your politics. Okay. And you see that your aunt or uncle posted something that you're just shocked by. So you just, let's make it easier. Let's say it's not your aunt and uncle. Let's say it's some friend of your aunt and uncle. Okay. So you feel like you should just get in there and tell them what's what.
For our previous president kind of thing. We don't talk about.
No, that's why I'm staying right in the middle, because this works for either side. For either side, people are creating content on social media to garner outrage.
Yep.
They know that we're all walking around with a certain level of contempt, no matter which side you're on, Josh. You're walking around with this little bubbling level of contempt for the other side. And so people who produce content on social media, especially, they want to trigger our outrage. That's the goal. And some of us buy into that more than others. So we share stuff that's triggering outrage in others. Okay. So you and I, we say, or let's say, you know, my husband has a sister with a disability. Okay. She has very severe cerebral palsy. So his issue, he hates to see anybody making fun of anybody with a disability. So let's say he sees something on the internet that is making fun of somebody with a disability. That's his trigger issue, right? So now he's a good man. He's brave. He would want to make his statement and go against that mean thing said about the disability, right? But you know what he just did? If he leaves a comment, he just gave link juice to that mean thing. And you know what's going to happen next. All the people that liked the mean thing are going to chime in to beat him down. So that one comment that you added could be the source of hundreds and hundreds of other clicks that actually make that mean content rise to the top. So the first shift is to pause before you click on anything. Realize that your click is a vote, and you will get more with what you click on. Second one is to ignore more. I would guess that we could ignore about 80% of what we used to click on out of anger, boredom, or curiosity if we knew our click was a vote.
I think in general, like I mentioned earlier, my coworkers, like we all joke like, oh, don't click that. It's going to be in your algorithm. We know it, but it's maybe the mindset part we don't understand. It's the But if it's the, if everyone's doing it, should do it kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think it's as simple as most of us don't want to be a pawn.
Right.
I think most of us, I don't know anybody who says, oh, I love to get taken advantage of and have my good intention used against others. No, almost nobody's saying that. So people really need to realize that we are pawns in somebody else's agenda. If we participate in internet content, engage with internet content in any way that's not thoughtful or helpful. This is the criteria that I think we're moving towards in society. I think we're going to start rewarding people, Josh, who are thoughtful and helpful. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't hear things we don't want to hear. Like you can say hard things to me that I don't agree with, as long as I know you're being thoughtful, you've really thought it through, and your goal long-term is to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
We have antennas for thoughtful and helpful. We know the aunt who's shaming us and giving us a lecture because she worries about us or because she sees something lovely in us that we're not making rise to the top. We know the difference between that aunt and the aunt who's just constantly negative, who just constantly sees the worst in others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can accept a hard correction from a grandmother who says what we need to hear, right? We can hear hard things because we know that she's thoughtful and trying to be helpful. Whereas the person who's got an agenda, I think we can smell that from quite a distance. So that's what I tell people, is to look at the stuff that they want to comment on or engage in any way. And really say, here's the practical tip. Before I click on anything, Josh, I say, do we need more of this? Do we really need more of this? And if it's not helpful and thoughtful, I don't even care if it's on my team. I have political views. I have, you know, sensitivities. But even if it's somebody on my team saying something, I want to go, yeah, no. Because we do not need more division.
No, we don't. No, that's the biggest problem right now.
No, we do not need more outrage. So even if somebody on my team, I will tell you a story the other day. I am very choosy about what I listen to for news, you can imagine.
Yes.
And we'll get to news because I'll give you some practical tips on that too. But somebody had used my car and I turned on the car and started heading into town. One of my kids had, and it was on a particular news channel.
Okay.
And I always thought this newscaster that was speaking was very, I always thought he was very socially conscientious.
Okay.
But he was bragging about being on Clubhouse the night before in a clubhouse the other night and triggering everyone to start fighting. Who's bragging about that?
That's not something, especially if it's your job, you shouldn't be openly saying, I intentionally incited riot just for fun.
Yes. I got him going. He says, you know, I just love this way I have with triggering others. He actually said that. I almost had to pull the car over. This was somebody I thought was very socially conscious, but no, he was purposefully triggering others to get outraged.
But see, this is the one thing I tell people. I'm like, it's bad. And in general, it's not good. But like what cancel culture doesn't realize they're doing, they're bringing attention to someone over their feelings. Yes, feelings are important. But ultimately, it's... I jokingly say this to guests, my workers. It's like, if I get quote canceled, I'm like, actually, that would be a great thing because I'm going to spread quicker. Yes, there'll be a lot of outreach for like the next month or two, but they'll find someone else kind of thing. I said, but I don't want that. I don't want that attention because then I would truly have to go full hermit till whenever. And I'm like, but it's those who are willing to deal with it is a powerful tool.
Yeah. But they're using our lizard brain against us.
Exactly.
Don't forget, that's what that guy was doing. He was very consciously knowing that people are in their online lives on autopilot. And it's super easy where we're on autopilot to trigger our worst impulses.
So you're actually touching on a book I've read. I'm assuming you probably read it or know of it. It's Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yes, it's so lovely. It's probably right on that shelf behind me, I'm sure.
I kind of see it over there. Yeah. But that is the biggest one that made me realize, like, oh, like you're saying, stop. Just think about it for, like, even a second. That's enough for your brain to register that, oh, maybe I shouldn't.
Absolutely. And if you love that book, here's the second one to read right after it. I would say anybody that that's listening to this podcast that's having a few aha moments, Think Fast and Slow is really a great book. Here's the second one I've just read.
Think Again by Adam Grant. Okay.
Yeah. Think Again by Adam Grant. Adam Grant is probably the best business thinker in the world right now. He's very high up. I'm not sure what his position is actually. Maybe it says on the cover at the Wharton School of Business, which is,
oh, that's huge.
It's huge. It's huge. And he is a social psychologist as well as a business guy. And he is talking in this book about how we rethink our notions about things and how powerful that is. If we keep expanding what we know and stop protecting so hard the things that we think are true. And I tell you, my brother and I think exactly opposite on politics.
Interesting.
But my brother's the kind of guy that would listen to Adam Grant exactly like I would, and would sit there going, oh, of course. Oh, okay. I've got to expand my notions on that. This is a great book for all business people, because part of doing business is keeping up.
It really is.
You have to know more about the world every day so that you can make decisions that work in the world out there. That's why I have ways that I access the news. So a lot of people, Josh, might think that somebody like me has just turned off the news and just, you know, avoids it at all costs. But I really think that's a dangerous, now there's some danger for you. If you know nothing about the wider world, or maybe worse yet, if your view of the wider world is really skewed by only listening to the most polarizing voices in the news. So I've really worked hard to try and find a few places where you can access some not polarizing news. And I know these fall far short of perfect.
But yeah, you can't expect perfection.
But I tell you, I've really looked at it. And okay. I just to tell, to not to, not to go down the politics road at all, but I grew up in one of the most conservative places in the country, Central Illinois. So I know that whole way of thinking.
Yeah.
And I've lived for 30 years in Vermont, which is completely the opposite. So I understand the whole scope of the spectrum of ways we can look at the world through our politics. And what I've decided is that it takes me 12 minutes to drive from my home into my dental practice. And when I go in the morning, I listen to National Public Radio. And I figure whatever's on during that 12 minutes, and surely people who are listening to this broadcast might find flaws in National Public Radio. But for now, it's the least bias we can find. And I use my critical thinking brain. I use my cerebral cortex, even when I'm listening to the news, to say, yeah, there's probably a other side to that. And yeah, there's probably another side to that. So I get my 12 minutes there. And I listen on the way home to the BBC. The BBC is very, very apolitical. And it's a global, the BBC World News.
Mm-hmm.
So I find out what's going on in the United States in the morning and I find out what's going on in the world in 12 minutes and 12 minutes. I tell you, if something doesn't make that little window, it's probably not that important.
Yeah.
And I keep up that way.
Yeah. For me, what I do is one of my phones, I have Google, but I meticulously groom it. I tell it, like, I'm not interested in this. But essentially, even if I told it, like, let's say a while ago something involving Kanye again, and he wasn't running for president. So I told it not to, but I'm like, interesting though. I'm like, I looked at it, but I didn't open it. I'm like, okay. So sure enough, it just because I looked at it, 2 days later, someone actually mentioned, oh, did you hear about Kanye? I'm like, you know, I looked at the article. I didn't read it. What was it about kind of thing? So it's one of those, they're like, oh, okay, he's not stupid. He knows, but he's not engaging kind of thing.
Right. Well, here's what you're doing. And this is what I really encourage everyone to do. Pay attention to what you're giving your attention to.
Yes.
Because what we give our attention to expands. Mm-hmm. This is so true of negativity, the thoughts we have about a coworker that are negative. If all we do is focus on how that coworker drives us crazy, guess what? They drive us crazier and crazier and crazier, right? Mm-hmm. If all we do is lament about how Thanksgiving dinner is going to be so terrible tomorrow because I have to be in the presence of somebody in my family that I hate, it turns out that way, right? I mean, what we give our attention to expands. Exactly. So I think that there's some real room to curate your incoming. Well, this is a really important piece of advice I like to talk to people about.
All right. How do we
curate
do that?
Curate your incoming.
Like the way I was saying, where you tell it, okay, I see that, but I don't want to see it anymore. Unrecommended kind of thing.
Yeah. And you can unfollow. I was in my podcast the other day talking to this wonderful gal, Julia Parsak, and she's a thought leader in this world of body image. Like, let's just give it up. My genes come from people who had scarcity. So mm-hmm. I'm chunkier than most because my genes tell me that I got to save calories. Whereas I've got a daughter who got my husband's side of the family skinny gene. She's never going to be built like me. I'm never going to be built like her. So Julia Parsak has this wonderful organization she's built around body image and us just letting it go, that we are who our genetics are going to leave us with. And she said to me, Linda, she says, you know what I did when I really figured out that social media had a grip on me and was changing my self-image and leaving me feeling like I had a sick in the pit of my stomach? She goes, I just went through my feed and if there were too many people that were constantly, you know, constantly elevating how powerful it was to be thin or constantly elevating things about body image, I just unfollowed. I mean, we can do that. That she was the one who laid on me this notion of curating our incoming. Mm-hmm. So if there are things that you subscribe to that are coming your way, the internet certainly does now give us so much autonomy in deciding what to filter out. And that's gotten more important than what we let through.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like you said, it's a tool. It's not meant to be a cure-all. So like if you know how to use a hammer, like you said, it can create, but it also can destroy. Depends on how you use it.
Yes. I love your wording there. So let me take with the remaining time that we've got and give people a whole bunch to be really hopeful about, Josh. Okay. So in my book, Happiness is an Option, I tell the story of how the internet came to be in the shortest possible way I can tell it. Okay. Or it can be told. So in 1993, there were 130 websites. 130.
Okay.
And you've got to remember that there weren't some evil geniuses rubbing their hands together, inventing the internet. No, they were engineers that were running into work every day because they were figuring out a way to connect us all or connect us to information really quick. I mean, that was they had good intention. This technology was obviously going to let us all access each other and information much quicker. But no one knew what they were starting. No one had any idea. In 10 years, there were 40 million websites.
Wow.
130 to 40 million in 10 years. And nobody could get their arms around this. Nobody could control this. And it needed an organizing principle. And unfortunately, the organizing principle became our attention. in the very beginning when it started to grow, it was easy to say to yourself, oh, well, if a lot of people go over there to that thing, it must be important. It must be good. It must be valuable. So attention decided what rose to the top. Well, as we know, the things that rise to the top are not good and not necessarily valuable, the most valuable, not necessarily trustworthy. But it did get away from us. So that's where we're at now, is we have an economy on the internet that nothing else matters, not how good your intention are or how hard you worked or what have you. But here's what I see coming. I see a gratitude economy coming. I see that people have just about had it with being interrupted and all this outrageousness. I really do not hear people saying, oh, I love all this outrage, division, and negativity. No.
No.
No one's saying that. And what we are doing, 62% of us now identify as values-driven consumers. We are literally looking at what we can find out about companies. And if they look like they match our values, we'll buy from them. But if they're not, we'll go shopping for somebody else who's treating their workers well or not using child labor or what have you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I had a nice little conversation, very brief, right before about this thing. Like you mentioned some examples of folks that get called out really quick on Twitter, and then that's it.
It's done. And it's some of them are truly is sad, where it's like they didn't do anything wrong, but like you said, the attention it got out of control. Now he or she is branded as whatever. But I agree. I kind of see something similar, like a renaissance almost for the internet. It's like the renaissance with crypto, but also just in general, like why should we give someone our hard-earned money, but also our attention when they're doing devious and evil things?
Yeah. I hear your generation, Josh, talking more and more in ways that makes me think you guys care about the greater good more than my generation.
It's the like the running joke of I could be paraphrasing it terribly wrong, where it's like the boomers intended to kill it, but now we have to fix their problem kind of thing.
I don't know. Generalizations are always a dangerous
territory.
It's
super dangerous. It is. Because there's always an exception to the rule.
Oh, always, always, always. So we're treading on very thin ice, which I'll acknowledge right now. And what I do know is that 62% of consumers identify as values-driven people who will, you know, let's say you want a pair of socks.
Okay.
Okay. So my husband needed a pair of socks the other day. You know, he's 61 years old and he still went on the internet, found Bombas socks because he'd heard over and over again that they're giving socks to homeless folks. And he said, I'm going to buy a pair of socks right now, either way. So I might as well give my money to someone who's going to make the world a little better place.
Okay. That's awesome. Yeah, that's what my terrible phrasing was trying to allude to. It's like we realize it's important to help the communities, even if it's a simple pair of socks, which from the few times I've served food before COVID, that's the biggest thing. They're like, thank you for the food. That's great. But it's like, our feet are cold though.
I know. So, and there is business after business after business, and we write about them on Ever Widening Circles. So you'll see a lot of the articles there. We have things divided into categories. So people can start out in the area that they love. It might be nature, might be art, might be technology, what have you. We have lots of categories. But then I tell people to experiment in other categories. But we do write about innovation like that, like Mama's socks or, you know, Warby Parker's glasses. This is a key point.
Okay.
Maybe this is a fundamental difference in the generations. My generation definitely thinks that when you say, oh, it's such a good deal, the word it's a good deal means you're getting the most you can possibly get for your money. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, if we recommend a good restaurant, we'll say, they give you so much food for $10 or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. My generation thinks a good deal is how much more you can get for your money. But I hear from your generation more and more often that a good deal is how much your money can do after you've spent it, how much more it can do. For instance, you know, you can buy a pair of glasses at Warby Parker and pay the same amount. Glasses are very expensive. But you will have the satisfaction of knowing they will give a pair of glasses to someone in need. So your money does more.
Right.
For the greater good. And I tell you, in the gratitude economy that's revving up right now, I don't think it's a matter of when people start participating and really start celebrating their role in the gratitude economy. I think it's a matter of if. Because if you don't, you are going to be called out for having child labor in your supply chain. You're going to be called out for some diabolical thing that your founder did. You are going to be called out for not making the world a little bit better place with your prosperity. Mm-hmm. So I'm very hopeful about the fact that the internet will change with this wave. And that we're going to start to look sideways at people who are ratcheting up the drama and making the world a worse place.
Right. No, that's perfect. I'd love to cut it there. I'll be shooting you an email after this so we can have all the links we talked about so they can all go to this. This is powerful. I'd love to get you on in the future because I feel like we could have gone for at least 3 hours.
But we're both a little busy. There's so many things I didn't get to mention. I tell you what, as soon as we launch the Business of Goodness video series and we really get this new branding all down, it'll be even more helpful. Right now, we've created so many things, Josh, and they're all separate. Mm-hmm. And they all still point to goodness in this wave. But we really felt like, heck, when I was on a podcast interview like this, I'd have to give people like 7 different places to go.
Yeah.
And I want people to be able to connect with the conspiracy of goodness. And can I leave people with one more hopeful sign?
Absolutely.
Okay. So one day when things were dark, and I'm not always the most cheerful person in the world. I mean, I can get discouraged.
Me.
I can get discouraged just like anyone else. So I was having a discouraging day. And somehow I happened to go over to LinkedIn, which I don't go that often, but I saw this incredible thing. The World Economic Forum hired the University of London, the University of Pennsylvania to do a study to find out exactly how many people it takes to take something from the fringe of society and it just becomes the norm. Like in my world, how many people do I have to get to know that their click is a vote and that means they can create a better world with it? How many people have to know that before we can actually change the world and reimagine the internet? Now, on my bad days, Josh, I might think it's about 80%. Like 80% of people need to know this before anything changes. And on a good day, I might say 51%. 51% of people need to have to know this before we can actually see change. Do you know what the real number is?
I would assume it's anywhere between 30 to 15%.
It's 25%. You're so right. You're so right. Okay. So the thing is that there's a lot of neuroscience, like we talked about earlier, about belonging and our need to follow others and all that stuff. Once 25% of people know that their click is a vote and they start using it to make the internet behave, mm-hmm. for us, you know, act on our behalf for a better future. Once 25% of people know, the rest goes through like a domino effect through society. And I think that's a hopeful number. I don't know about your friends and in your orbit, but 25% of the people I know want a better world.
Yes. Now, I think intrinsically, unless you're really, really wired differently, all humans want a better world in general.
Yes, for everyone. We're all so alike. It's not even funny.
People it's everywhere. One of those. It's like we may be 7.6 billion people, but unless you're like that weird like 2% of the populace that's just literally wired different, we all intrinsically want the same thing.
Yeah, we want to know that when we go to sleep tonight, we don't have to worry about being, you know, we'll wake up safe. We want to know where our next meal's coming from. Mm-hmm. We want to know that if we work hard, that a brighter future is possible. This is the same everywhere around the planet.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, we can get there and you're part of it. So thanks for sharing this, all these sentiments with your audience.
Thank you so much for coming on. Definitely going to have to reach out and get you on in the future very soon once everything's up and running.
Great. Okay, Josh. Well, for now, people can go to everwideningcircles.com to find all these amazing articles and connection to this world you never knew existed. And the app. This is the way you can support us best right now, Josh.
Okay.
Our app is $1 a month or $10 a year. And we priced it that way so that even someone who's very poor in some very poor country can afford to get access to all this goodness.
That's beautiful.
That is the way to support Ever Widening Circles now. And we are creating the Conspiracy of Goodness Network and the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast and all this. You and I and everyone who's listening to this, we can open a new era.
It's going to be a beautiful one too. I appreciate everything and everything we've gone into.
All right. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, congratulations. You made it to the end. You're an awesome person. Not many make it here. So, being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? If you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome and see you next time.